This is On Shifting Ground. I'm Ray Suarez. In the early days of the invasion, cameras caught thousands of women and children crossing the Ukrainian border to seek shelter and safety in the European Union. Putin's war has sent shockwaves around the world, and today, millions of Ukrainian refugees are straining the EU and other Western nations. The war has caused another migration that's received far less attention. At the beginning of the invasion, many Russians fled abroad because they knew they were under direct threat for speaking out against the war. Others left because they feared getting drafted to serve in the Russian army. One city where Russians started arriving in droves last year is Bishkek, the capital of the former Soviet republic, now independent Central Asian nation, Kyrgyzstan. Bishkek is a small city of old Soviet-era apartment blocks and streets clogged with traffic that stands below the towering, snow-capped peaks of the Tian Shan Mountains. Recently, at a cafe in the city, we caught up with a young man from Moscow named Alexander.
All over the country, the big part of Russians support what's happening, and I can't understand it.
When the war began last February, Russians like Alexander took to the streets in cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg to protest. Police swiftly arrested thousands of protesters and jailed well-known dissidents.
I don't believe that protest working in Russia because it's too many military, it's too many police forces, and it cannot have some political result. And I couldn't stay in Russia anymore.
Many Russians like him have no intention of returning home as long as Vladimir Putin remains in power. But for Alexander, the reality of living long-term in a new country, thousands of miles away from home, and his fiancée back in Moscow, was starting to weigh heavily on him.
I don't have any friends here. I have few locals with whom I have some conversation. Also, I have calls with my fiancé, with my parents, or with my friends. I think I feel a little bit lonely.
Since the war started, an estimated 500,000 Russians have poured into former Soviet countries like Kyrgyzstan, Georgia, and Armenia, countries where they don't need visas. For some, this migration is similar in scale to the flow of Russians who fled the country after the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. But not everyone is welcoming their new Russian neighbors with open arms. Reporter Levi Bridges is based in Bishkek. For him, the influx of Russians has been impossible to ignore because it's completely reshaping life in the city. Levi takes it from here.
Over the last year, I've met dozens of Russians who left the country because of the war. And I don't think a single one has talked about their own problems without first mentioning that they obviously pale in comparison to the horror Ukrainians are going through right now. But in all honesty, the war has really upended their lives, too. Since the war started, there have been two waves of Russian migrants. The first left right after the war. A lot of them were activists, journalists, and human rights defenders who would have been in danger if they hadn't left the country. In Russia, even just calling the conflict a war now is a criminal offense. Then, last September, a second, much larger wave of Russians fled the country after Russia announced a partial draft. Russian authorities started picking men up right on the street in Moscow and hauling them off to the army. Almost overnight, tens of thousands of young Russian men started arriving in cities like Bishkek. Inside a library in downtown Bishkek, with sunlit wooden floors and shelves stacked with old hardcovers of Tolstoy, I meet up with one young man who fled the draft. He didn't want to give his name because admitting you left the country to avoid conscription is a criminal offense. Sitting near students flipping through these old yellowed newspapers, he told me that after Russia announced the draft, it felt like he was living under constant threat.
сама вот эта угроза, которая над тобой нависла.
He says it was impossible to work or focus on anything. All he could do was obsessively read the news on his phone and doom scroll.
Вот как это называется, doom scrolling.
This young man didn't have a military background, so he says his risk of getting called up to fight was pretty small.
И понятно, что им уже не важно на самом деле.
But he says that's not important to Russian authorities because they just want to march you off to war and throw you in the meat grinder.
И как бы использовать вот в этой военной мясорубке.
Lots of Russians I talked to said they had plans to leave Russia well before the war, because they don't want to live in a country ruled by Putin. But the draft forced them to speed up those plans.
Понял, что нужно к этому как-то готовиться, то есть, например, там, готовить какие-то документы.
After the draft was announced, he packed up his belongings in a little bag, brought along his university diploma in case he needed to find a job abroad, and took a bus to the Russian border.
Собираю маленькую сумку вот такую вот и уезжаю вечером в Казахстан на автобусе.
Many Russian draft dodgers are young progressives who have been protesting for years. They feel like their personal well-being suffered under Putin even before the war started. This young man I meet in the library feels especially threatened because he's bisexual.
То есть я сейчас себя мыслю как бисексуал, но...
In the last decade, the Russian government has repeatedly restricted the rights of LGBTQ people.
Или лучше вот так не говорить, или там лучше не... вот это не постить.
He says in Russia he constantly thought about what he should or shouldn't wear, and what's safe to write online about your personal views. Those fears now apply to all Russians who don't support the war.
У меня была идея, что вот я хочу во Францию.
He hopes to eventually leave Kyrgyzstan and move to France. Most days he comes to this library to take French lessons with local students.
Cinema ou cinéma?
Cinéma.
Tu as quel âge?
Having all these Russians trying to integrate into life here, it's complicated. There's lots of historical baggage. Like, during the First World War, Russians killed more than 100,000 Central Asians, including here in Kyrgyzstan, as part of a crackdown on locals who rebelled because they didn't want to fight in the war with Russia. And now, 100 years later, some anti-war Russians are showing up here because they want peace. On a recent Friday night, I visit a new community center in Bishkek, founded by Russian activists from St. Petersburg, that's putting on a small concert. In the living room, a small crowd is sitting on wooden chairs before a musician strumming a guitar. Oil paintings on the walls and tall bookshelves are bathed in the soft light from a lamp in the shape of a mushroom. The Russians who created this space wanted to turn their exile in Kyrgyzstan into something positive. They've started volunteer projects with local Kyrgyz organizations, and they put on events that give people a chance to just relax and have some fun. Many Russians in Bishkek mainly just hang out with other Russians. The founders of Red Roof want to change that. They're receiving lots of attention for those efforts.
Downstairs is the common living room.
When I sat down with Yulia Kulishova, one of the founders of Red Roof, earlier this winter, I noticed a couple cameramen poking their head around a corner. This is your next interview?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yes.
That's amazing. Are they from, when the war first started, Yulia and her husband, Ilya, went to protests every day. But that quickly became dangerous.
They started to come to the houses of activists at the early mornings, break doors and arrest them. And I felt really scared. We couldn't sleep. It's very sad to say, but I felt like it's already too late to do anything. And we decided to leave.
For Yulia, moving to Central Asia showed her things about herself that she didn't really like. Countries like Kyrgyzstan and Georgia were colonized by Russia in the 19th century and absorbed into the Russian Empire. similar to how Spain colonized Mexico. But Yulia says Russians aren't really taught about this colonial history in school. You're just given one message.
We're also told that Russia is super great and a great power. That's how most of Russian people are brought up.
Yulia told me that this mindset gives lots of Russians a superiority complex. They look down on people from other former Soviet countries.
And especially about Central Asia, we've been told that these countries are miserable, poor. And for lots of Russians who came in Kyrgyzstan, it was a big surprise to figure that Kyrgyzstan is better and more developed than Russia. For example, freedom of speech, which was so painful to realize. But in Kyrgyzstan, it's more free than in Russia. There is more press, more media, more protests.
It also genuinely surprised Yulia that Bishkek has all the amenities of any Russian city. Entertainment, nice restaurants, a great private school for her daughter. Moving here made her realize that deep inside, she also harbored these feelings that Russia was somehow superior to neighboring countries, places that were oppressed and ruled by Russia for centuries. So now, for her, living in Kyrgyzstan has become about way more than just finding a place to seek safety.
I also wanted to stay here to get rid of this arrogance and imperialistic ideas that we definitely have, each of us.
What's so ironic about this Russian migration is that for decades now, migrants have left countries like Kyrgyzstan to work low-wage jobs in Russia. It's not easy for them. They encounter a lot of racism there. When I lived in Moscow, I constantly saw police in the metro just stopping anyone who looks Asian to check their documents. Now, migration is moving the other way. Nobody saw that coming. And it's creating tension. Lots of Russians moving to countries like Kyrgyzstan have remote jobs that pay them far more than the local salary. So after the draft started, rents in cities like Bishkek or Tbilisi increased by 2 or 3 times, almost overnight. It's causing a housing crisis that's making life a lot harder for local people.
Oh, wow, there's a movie theater?
Cinema, yeah.
On a dark street in the outskirts of Bishkek, I meet up with a young woman on a freezing winter night named Kunduz Kurumbayeva.
Where are we right now?
We are in Tumguch. This is Subanata Street. We are far away from the center. I feel very bored here.
Kunduz and her sister used to have a sweet apartment smack dab in the city center. But after the Russians started arriving, Kunduz's landlord knocked on her door.
He gave us only 4 or 5 days to move. And we said, it's not okay. We cannot find a nice apartment in 4 or 5 days. But he said, I don't care. Just get out.
The landlord wanted to triple the rent from $250 a month to $900.
And he said he has a person to pay such money. And that is why we need to move.
And the person was from Russia?
Yep.
Landlords just started evicting people all over the city to rent to Russians. Kunduz actually got fired from her job because she had to take so much time off to find a new place to live. She eventually ended up out here in a brand new apartment.
But there was no heating, and in this time for extremely cold winters, this is disaster.
They bought some little portable heaters to get them through the cold months. While this was going on, some really privileged Russians started whining on social media about how undeveloped Central Asia is. In this video on YouTube, a pretty famous Russian blogger complains about how bad the roads are in Kyrgyzstan. In a separate post on Instagram, he went on a tirade about how bad the customer service is here. I remember when this video and lots of others like it started coming out, it really annoyed people here.
I mean, objectively speaking, they're fleeing the war, right? But then they're complaining about not having their favorite brand of peanut butter or a store that they're used to.
Azamat Junisbai is a sociology professor at Pitzer College in Claremont, California. But he grew up in Almaty, Kazakhstan, just north of Bishkek. I follow him on Twitter, and I wanted to talk to him because he's been tweeting a lot recently about how the war has brought up all kinds of complicated feelings for him.
I am probably one of the most Russified Kazakhs you'll ever meet, and I grew up speaking Russian. So my Kazakh is truly awful. I grew up with Russian culture. Most of my friends were Russian.
It wasn't until much later in life that Azamat realized he also internalized this sense of Russian superiority, even though he's not an ethnic Russian.
And it's still uncomfortable for me to talk about it, but I think I felt contempt almost for those who were Kazakh speakers or for those who had even the slightest hint of a Kazakh accent, because Kazakh was considered a lower status language.
When Azamat became an adult, he started understanding what it really meant to grow up in a country colonized by Russia. One of his family members was executed in this old KGB building at a park he used to play in as a kid. Russians tested nuclear bombs in his country and caused huge environmental disasters. Azamat says these historical facts just aren't as present for many Russians as they are for him. They see Russia more as a country that brought culture and civilization to the far reaches of the Soviet Union.
It's just that sense of, I don't support Putin, but look at all the great composers we have, and Dostoevsky and this and that, right? That stuff is still there. The very much taken for granted sense of superiority.
Now, Azamat sees clearly how this Russian superiority even got to him too, in the way he once looked down on Kazakh speakers. The sense that Russia is somehow better than its neighbors, it partially explains why Putin invaded Ukraine. Putin, Azamat argues, has consolidated power by playing into a Russian longing for restoring an empire built on Russia's great culture. He says it concerns him that some progressive Russians call the conflict Putin's war instead of Russia's war. For him, calling the conflict Putin's war absolves Russians of a collective and historical responsibility in this conflict.
You know, saying, oh, this is Putin's war, is a way to not have to look the truth in the face, right? To not really see what's there. But I think for those of us who are not Russian, but who have been previously colonized by Russia, it's very plain to see that Putin did not come out of a vacuum. Right, he's simply exploiting what's already there. And I think any attempt to say, oh, we are simply victims and we don't have any agency in this is dishonest, I think. It's cowardly almost.
I really wanted to know how someone who recently fled Russia might respond to some of these critiques. So I talked about some of them with Yulia Kuleshova, the Russian activist who founded the Red Roof Community Center in Bishkek.
People don't know what fight Russian people had at last decade, and they think that Russian people have been silent, and it's so unfair. And then I hear that Russians are cowards, and I feel extremely unhappy because me and my friends were staying in Russia, being arrested, staying in prisons, and now these Russians are blamed in being not good enough.
One sort of complaint I hear from people who are from Central Asia is that Russians who come here, they don't support Putin, but they also don't see Russia as a former colonial power. Do you think that's true? And if so, why has that happened?
I think that we just don't have awareness at this topic because awareness comes from government, from education, and we just don't have this context at all. So we're absolutely blind about this part of Russian history. But even me, I was so blind, and I'm in a way ashamed of this. I would think deep in myself that Kyrgyzstan is less developed than Russia. I would also use these repulsive terms as civilized people and not civilized.
What do you mean by that?
That in Russia we oftentimes judge people by being not civilized. There is such a saying in Russia, let's do something like white people. For example, oh, let's sit not on the floor, but on couch as white people. I mean, that's how we are blind and unaware of racist and colonial and other stuff. And I believe that Russia is in such bad political situation because so many citizens have been believing in this Russian power and this Russian superiority and right to conquer different countries and make decisions for them.
These days, it feels like the war in Ukraine has really started a cultural reckoning in this part of the world. For me, it honestly kind of feels like the months after George Floyd was murdered in the US. Suddenly, people are starting to have difficult conversations about race and privilege for the first time. Yulia wishes they had them earlier, before the war started.
Unfortunately, my adorable grandmother is supporting the government. She lives in a very different informational sphere. She's 87, so she listens to state media for all of her life, and she doesn't have alternative sources. And I also feel a little bit guilty that I was not brave enough to bring these topics in our communication. We try to discuss, and we met this irritation, and we have been silent. But maybe we had to go deeper.
On a recent Saturday morning in Yulia's community center, Russian children gather to play board games together. Yulia told me this war has deeply affected her daughter. When her kid hears people knocking on the door now, she sometimes asks whether it's Russian security services coming to interrogate her parents because of their activism. This war is deeply affecting multiple generations of people throughout the former Soviet space. It's impossible to take away just the sheer level of violence and devastation this war is causing. But it doesn't feel like there's any way to reverse the cultural reckoning that's come with it either. Right now, they both seem to be gaining momentum.
You've been listening to On Shifting Ground, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from listeners like you. Today's episode was produced by Elise Manoukian and Andrew Stelzer, with special production from Levi Bridges in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. It was mixed and mastered by Matteo Schimpf. Additional production and engineering were provided by Rob Spate. KQED's Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Jared Sport is our executive producer. Philip Yun is CEO of World Affairs. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.